ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5, presented by Zadok Jewelers, KFNC and KFNC HD2, Mont Belvieu, Houston.
The Killer Bees!
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of the Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town, and happy Friday!
Yes, happy Friday indeed. Friday edition of the Killer Bees. He's Joel, I'm Jeremy, and the Astros pretty happy as well. Magic number down to 10. They cleaned up on the Rangers, took 3 of 4. The 3 games that they won were in convincing fashion, including the series finale last night. It didn't go as planned. Framber Valdez got scratched from the start because he cut his finger
literally
on the wall.
He literally got scratched.
Yeah, he did. By the wall.
Yeah.
By the wall there in Arlington, shagging BP balls by the Astros offense. And then the Astros took some BP against Glenn Otto. No offense, Glenn Otto. He's a Houston kid. Went to Rice. But the Astros lit him up on their way to a 12-1 victory. Always nice to get these laughers, especially on a getaway day as they come back to Houston, begin a 3-game series tonight.
Now, if you're the cynical Astros critic slash fan, you're coming out of that game and you're asking, well, why did they have the one bad game? Why couldn't they just had, you know, keep going with the games that they've had against the Rangers in between the stinker where they had 15 runs, 12 runs? What happened in between? Well, these things happen. That's how baseball goes. And sometimes a pitcher gets hot or for whatever reasons that we don't know, guys aren't on their game for a certain night. But the good news was is that after one of each, they came back out hot. They rolled the Rangers like they're supposed to. And now, when I was talking cross talk with Charlie, no, I don't think they're going to win 14 out of 16 and get to 100 wins. But I do think that they are kind of in the right direction, going in the right direction to get ready for the playoffs.
I would say even trying to win 14 of 16 would not be the wisest of moves for this team. And I know that they're still in the race right there for the top seed in the AL, as they hope that Tampa Bay loses some games down the stretch. And I got some help yesterday as the White Sox lost. So you're 3 games clear of Chicago for at least home foot advantage in the divisional series. You also have the tiebreaker on the White Sox. So 3-game lead plus the tiebreaker because you won the season series. Meanwhile, 4.5 back of Tampa. It's still not out of reach, but don't feel great about it. You do, of course, play Tampa 3 games there in the second-to-last series of the season. But winning 14-16, not likely, but they don't need to. They're fine. They're fine where they're at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, whether they catch the Rays or not, as long as the White Sox have to go through Minute Maid, to me, they're fine because of the fact that I think that does mean something. And like you and I talked about, I don't think it means a whole lot when you have to go to the Trop and play the Rays in the rinky-dink garbage can stadium and with fans that are kind of as fair weather as, you know, a Frank Billingsley forecast. You have to deal with it.
What does that mean?
You know, like, you know, a weatherman. I mean, you could forecast they could go either way. They could show up. They couldn't. I mean, you could be right. You could be wrong. I mean, it could be rain. It could be not. That's what the Trop is. White Sox fans are going to be fired up. And we know that there was a little extra because of their TV crew and talking some smack during the year about the garbage cans and the cheaters. But the fact of the matter is that it means something because as the weather starts to change in the Midwest, though it won't here, it's going to start getting colder too. And when playoff baseball is at its peak, it's fall in the Midwest. And the climate has a tendency to change, and it can be a factor in a baseball game. So the fact that you would control it so that you're in the optimal environment for your team and make them come through here, I'm fine.
Yep. Luis Garcia got the start yesterday after Framber Valdez was scratched. They said they told Luis Garcia the night before, so this was something that the Astros knew the night before, didn't announce it until just before, hours before the game, a little gamesmanship there, I suppose. Luis Garcia was going on full rest, pitched well. Look, 1 run over 5 1/3, 87 pitches, in which seems to be the trend nowadays with just 17 games left in the regular season and the playoffs on the horizon for the Houston Astros. After every start, we kind of nitpick and micromanage to see if, hey, is this something that helped his case to be in the playoff rotation? Luis Garcia, for me, still probably the man looking outside of the four-man rotation. He's going to be valuable. He's somebody that's going to be an important piece. I just don't see him making a start for the Houston Astros because of the four guys ahead of him with Urquidy, with Greinke, with Framber, and with McCullers.
So what separates Urquidy from Garcia for you? Because I'll say this, whether it's quote-unquote short rest or because they have a surplus of starting pitchers trying to get more rest lately, that he wasn't like trying to do too much when he came out there. But what I left with was a guy I have confidence in. I mean, the way he took control and stayed in control of a baseball game, granted, it's the Rangers. But you know what? He didn't have that really rough first inning. He didn't have a 30-pitch inning. He didn't have some of the things we've seen even from McCullers, but we've seen from Fromber, and we've seen, obviously, from Odorizzi and other guys, like even a Zach Greinke. So I believe that he's showing you enough that he has to be into consideration, because you don't know what you're getting from Greinke yet either. That's why this whole last 16 games has to play out.
Garcia 11-7 now, the 3.37 ERA, and if he's jumping anybody for me, he's jumping Zach Greinke. But I still think Dusty's mindset's going to be game one, game two, Lance McCullers, Framber Valdez. If you need to use Jose Urquidy in game one or two, you will. If you need to use Luis Garcia in game one or two, you will. So I think that fourth game still kind of a toss-up. I think you slot Zach Greinke in there because he's the veteran and he's done it before. Although, hadn't pitched all that well, and maybe Dusty would do something that you wouldn't think Dusty would do, and that's sit down the veteran over one of the youngsters.
I think Fromber needs a pair of ski gloves if he's going to be out at batting practice anymore either, that are highly padded and warm, because I don't need any more fingers in the wrong spots. I mean, how the hell is he catching batting practice balls and somehow scratches a finger?
Yeah, I'm curious about the wall there, too, in Arlington, that he scratched a finger on the wall. Like, is there, I mean,
I'm curious
I don't know
about
what's going
the
on.
Story.
Here, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've been through a lot of these where you could say one thing to the public and it could be completely different for how it actually happened, because I don't think it had anything to do. Look, if, let me put it to you this
way. It's also minor, though, because they expect him to pitch Monday.
Yeah, so it can't be that bad, but at the same time, that's why I don't think it can be the wall. Let's remember now that our boy Ted hit the wall with his face, right?
He did.
Tuck hit the wall with his face, and he laughed it off, but Fromber hits it with his finger, and suddenly we have issues? I don't think... Call me a cynic, but I don't think it had anything to do with his hand hitting the wall.
Yeah, you hear a lot of those BP injuries. Look, it's the bigs, and I understand that's like routine where pitchers shag BP. Should they be doing it this late in the season? 17 games left. You're about to start the playoffs. I know it's like routine, and it's just a baseball thing, but hey, maybe get the clubbies to do it. You know what I mean?
Get them the sliding gloves then. I want Fromber with sliding gloves on now if he's going to catch batting practice stuff with his throwing hand. It's the year of the finger for Fromber. I don't need any more digits being damaged.
That's a good point. He had the broken finger in spring training, cost him to miss the start of the season. Dusty Baker, after the win, was pleased with his guys.
You know, he did a great job. Sometimes short notice is the best way to go, but he was going on regular rest. We're trying to stretch him out to go six and possibly seven, but he ran into trouble in the six and looked like he'd had enough. But he did a great job. Maldi directed him through the game. I tell you, it really helped. That 3-run homer that Carlos Correa hit in the first inning. I mean, that was huge, especially, you know, was that the first inning or second inning?
Second or third.
Yeah, or second or third. And I think it was a third or fourth because the kid over there, man, from Houston, he, we hadn't scored a run off of him in eight innings, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was in the third, the fourth. So, he was dealing, up to then. But that was huge to break the ice for us to get some multiple runs. And then we had that big inning, that was a real big inning.
That was last
week.
We
scored seven, which we were capable of doing. So,
yeah, that was two games ago.
It was a good night, good series for us. We lost the one game, but, you'll take three out of four.
Yeah, that was
especially we hadn't had much success, I'm told, here in this stadium. Because I looked up on the board, and we didn't hardly have anybody that had a very good career record here in Texas. So that was big for us to come in here and win three out of four.
Now, I want to preface this by saying no one should text, call, or come at me, because I haven't said anything about being anti-Dusty. But this whole soundbite, which I had not heard previous to this show starting, just gave my man Jeremy every bit of ammo he could possibly need for, one, saying that the game has passed him by, and for, two, saying that this is the kind of guy that makes decisions for your baseball club and then crapping all over.
I'm not sure he's all there anymore. Look, I like Dusty, the guy. I'm not sure I want him being the manager of my baseball team. Carlos Correa hit a homer in the first or the second. No, it was the fourth, Dusty. It was the fourth inning that Correa hit the home run. Then he said that later we had the big inning. No, it was all in the same inning, the 7-run fourth, all in the same inning. I mean, I don't...
This goes back to the Royals series when you decided that you're not worried about pitching to a first baseman. You want to pitch to a first baseman because he was hot like 6 years ago in his heyday.
Yeah.
As opposed to pitching to Salvador Perez.
Dusty just goes into his postgame with like any mind of like what has happened. That'd be like us doing a show with like without any prep whatsoever and just start making things up. Oh yeah, Carlos home run. What was it, the first or the second? No, Dusty, it was the fourth inning when he hit the home run. And then Dusty starts saying, oh, that's right, Glenn Otto, the Houston kid. He was shoving those first few innings and then he asked for the big inning. Yeah, that was all on the same inning. Dusty Baker, manager of the Houston Astros. Did Luis Garcia do enough yesterday to convince you he should get a postseason start? 713-780-3776. And if so, who is he starting over? By the way, did you see the dominance of Josh James last night? Three up, Stop three it. Down in the ninth. Struck out two. Josh James is
dominance
back. He's back.
Dominance or the first signs of life and progress from a guy that's already, in my mind, been buried and put to rest like how many times? He finally had a clean inning.
He's back.
Let me remind you two nights earlier without using Dusty's memory. Let me remind you two nights earlier in a cakewalk of a game, he came in and gave up a run. When no one else had the problem of doing that, he found a way to do it then. I have seen more than enough of Josh James.
Was Carlos's home run in the first or the second? It was in the fourth inning, Dusty Baker. We got a busy show. Jerry Palm will be joining us a little bit later. Also joining on the program a little bit later as well, Danielle Lerner covers the Astros and the Rockets for the Chronicle. But coming up next, take a look at this matchup on Sunday. The Houston Texans and the Cleveland Browns. But also there's another big-time NFL guy that thinks Deshaun Watson could get traded during the season. Who it was, what he said next, Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, right now I want to tell you about the good man that I know as Dr. Linville. Dr. Linville, you've heard him being spoken about highly on this station. You've heard it from John Granato. You've heard it from Fred Fowler. You're going to hear it from more and more people around here because Doc Linville knows what he's doing and he gets results. I met with him a few weeks ago and said, look, you know what? My dad went bald at 21. I was lucky in the fact that I never had to deal with that. But now, as I get older, I look at it, and I don't have the hairline I once had. And I went and had a consultation, and he told me, I'm telling you right now, Joel, you're the perfect candidate. We can do something for that. Well, we're going to find out, because I'm going in tomorrow, and I'm going to get it done. And then I'm going to let you guys know as it progresses to see how it advances and how it goes. Because my hope is, if it goes anything like John and Fred, I'm going to be in a much better place in about 6 to 9 months. Because he explained the whole process to me, and it doesn't happen overnight. But it's your own hair, and they put it, it's just like not replacing it per se, it's repositioning it from the back of your head to the front of your head. You have so many follicles in the back of your head that you can spare them. They put them where you don't have the hair, and as it grows and gets stronger, it's like a baby's hair. Once it comes in the first time, it's fine. As it continues to grow and gets cut and regrows, it's going to get thicker and thicker. And about 6 to 9 months from now, it's going to be a totally different hairline. And I can't wait because I know he knows what he's doing. He's at the top of his field. He's an expert. And that's why I'm telling you guys to check him out because he knows what he's doing and he can get results for you if you've had issues, whether it be in the front of your head, the back of your head, or other places. They can do it. He's had the procedures done himself. It works for him. It can work for you, too. I want you to check it out right now and see how to contact him. Go to 975hair.com and check out all of the different the information and all the different people that you like John Granato and Fred that have gotten involved with Dr. Linville and gotten the results they wanted. You can get them, too. Check him out. Dr. Linville knows what he's doing. He's a great dude doing great things, and I'm excited. Tomorrow's the big day. I can't wait to get it done with Doc Linville. 975hair.com.
ESPN 97.5. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, who thinks Deshaun Watson's going to get traded in about 3 minutes? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776, HRP listener line. You can call or text. Texter saying Luis Garcia has been a gem mainly all season long. I believe he's going to start over Odorizzi in a heartbeat, and he might even start over Greinke if he doesn't turn it around. Speaking of Greinke, now, look, it's four-man rotation. The question isn't Oda Rizzi. Oda Rizzi is the odd man out. There's no way Oda Rizzi's making a start in the postseason unless Dusty just blows my mind in a different regard. The question becomes Luis Garcia and Zach Greinke.
Didn't he just blow your mind a second ago?
He does
ago?
It daily. Did you see the lineup yesterday?
Yeah, you were ready to jump on that, too.
I mean, I don't really – I mean, at this point, you're not really in a race. I think you're solidified into the number two spot. Like, to me, he's just experimenting, which is fine. I mean, I get it. This is the time of the season to experiment. But did it not baffle you a little bit that you had Jose Siri playing center field, Jake Meyers playing left, which, okay, Jose Siri, maybe a better athlete, barely, I don't know.
Maybe.
But batting ahead of Jake Meyers in the batting order.
Yeah, you know what, and I didn't want to be that guy again, but the thing that really just kept resonating with me is I keep saying this over and over again, Jake Meyers needs to be your everyday center fielder. So he doesn't need to be your everyday outfielder. He needs to be your everyday center fielder. And it doesn't matter what ballpark you're playing in or the nooks and crannies and nuances of a certain park versus another park. It matters that come playoff time, I want him in the middle of the diamond playing center field, playing great defense, and being the guy that he should be for this lineup on this team for this season. That means I don't care how speedy Siri is. I don't care that he, you know, I do care that he really had a good showing when he finally got put into the lineup, but I don't believe in any way, shape, or form he's proven himself to the level of Jake. So I think Jake should be in center field. If you're going to want the both guys in the lineup, then Siri can be in left because Brantley's out of the lineup and leave it there. But why in God's name was Meyers not in center field last night was the thing that just kept coming back at me going, I just don't get that.
Yeah, and I get like, hey, the lead in the division's so big. It's seven games. You have 17 to play. The magic number's down to 10. You have a three-game lead plus the tiebreaker over the White Sox. Stop criticizing that. It's a weird thing to nitpick. It's just weird. It's just a weird thing to have Siri in center and especially have Siri ahead of Meyers in the batting order I thought was just bizarre.
How many good managers in baseball, like you can take the best managers in baseball right now or some of the up-and-coming managers, how many managers in baseball would think like that?
I mean, I think some people at this point of the season where they're at, they might try different guys in different spots. Like, you want to see what Siri looks like in center field. But, like, Jose Siri might not even be on the playoff roster. Like, he might be, but he might not be. So maybe that's why they're experimenting with it. And, like, hey, is this somebody that we can trust in center field? But the really weird thing to me was the batting order, and I understand that that's not that big a deal. Chris Mortensen was on the Wheelhouse yesterday. He joined the guys. And he had some interesting things to say about Deshaun Watson. Look, Deshaun Watson currently on the 53-man roster. He's not active. In fact, he was somewhere on an island when the Texans were playing Sunday, celebrating his birthday.
He had his hands full, Jeremy.
He did have his hands full, which usually it's somebody else with their hands full around Deshaun Watson. But the fact
depends.
That it does depend. I mean, there's a lot of them. There's a big sample size there.
If you know something I don't, let me know. But I don't know if they had their hands full, but you know they had a situation on their hands. Let's put it that way.
Something was going on. AJ Perez of Front Office Sports says that he thinks it's unlikely that criminal complaints will conclude before November 2nd. The reason November 2nd is a critical date, it's big on the NFL calendar because that's the NFL trade deadline. So if you're a believer that if Deshaun Watson were to get traded, let's play the hypothetical, if he were to get traded, that the NFL is not going to do anything because there's nothing criminal currently in place for Deshaun Watson. There's some people, about half the people, that think if he got traded, that Roger Goodell would then step in and put him on the commissioner's exempt list. I don't believe that. The fact that there's nothing criminal and that the civil cases are in limbo and the NFL has a precedence in not really ruling on criminal on civil stuff until that stuff has been legislated and figured out in court and all that stuff, all that lingo, the legal lingo. The NFL showed precedence that they don't step in until that stuff has a conclusion and is finalized. I don't think Deshaun Watson would be placed on the commissioner exempt list if he was traded. Do you think he would have or he would be?
I think it would be the most NFL thing to do, that they refuse to do it until there's a chance that he gets a fresh beginning with a team that could actually capitalize on making a move for him. And then they go, whoa, wait a minute. This could go terribly wrong if we're publicizing and everybody's, you know, looking at and marketing this guy and his new team, and then suddenly we find out there's any truth to all this. This is why I kept saying from the minute that he showed up, he did what he had to do when he showed up for training camp, but after that point, the NFL, and I keep going back to this, look at the Trevor Bauer situation. Until it's all resolved, nothing goes to chance. I'm not letting him on the field.
See, I'm torn on that because why is he allowed on a 53-man roster and collect checks? You know what I mean? Like, why are they punishing the Texans in that sense and letting the Texans do the solid by not playing him and he's on the roster, but he's not on the roster, will be a healthy scratch. So I'm kind of torn on that. But if you're a believer in that, that he would be placed in the commissioner's exempt list if he was traded and he was in risk of actually playing, then there's no sense in anybody trading for him. And the rumors are the Dolphins were checking in with Goodell and they were checking in with the league office to see if they did trade for Watson, if there'd be something that the NFL would do. And we don't know because the Dolphins didn't trade him, but trade for him. But Chris Mortensen was on with the Wheelhouse yesterday. He's a believer that Deshaun Watson could still be traded.
I'll say, listen, I'm like a lot of people. November 2nd is the trading deadline. I'm of the mind right now that Deshaun Watson is going to play football this year, but that's just me speculating. It's not reporting. I just think that based off the calendar, unless we get an indictment from a grand jury, I think it's still possible he gets traded. I really do.
See, I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening for a couple of fronts. One, Nick Caserio doesn't strike me as somebody who's going to accept pennies on the dollar. He's going to roll the dice on this and let it play out so he can try to maximize the assets he gets back. Plus, you almost have to because he is the biggest asset you currently have in this organization and on this roster. And compared to the first-round draft pick you'll get next year for embracing the suck this year, it's going to be the two biggest pivotal decisions that Nick Caserio has. And then secondly, like if you are Miami, if you are Carolina, if you are Philadelphia, and these might not be great examples because Darnold looked pretty good in week one. Jalen Hurts looked outstanding for Philadelphia in week one. Tua looked all right for Miami in their win over the Patriots. Like, it's so risky to try to make that trade and then all of a sudden, boom, commissioner's exempt list.
Yeah, I just think that it's a mess getting messier by the moment. I can't believe we're still talking about it. I can't believe that, you know, look, it was a great get by the Wheelhouse to get Mort. There was a lot of other things that we can pull from Mort that were, you know, tangible. Obviously, because he said it, we're talking about it. I just think that it's all much ado about nothing because, as you said, if I'm Nick Caserio, it's my most I've been harping on the fact that it's the only real, true, valuable asset that you have right now. So until you know where everybody's picking, until you know, so that you don't pull a James Harden move, so that you don't trade him where he, because he has a no trade. So because you don't get in a situation where you can only trade him where he wants to go, and the teams that he wants to go are already winners, so you're not going to get a high draft pick, a quote-unquote lottery-type pick. You're going to end up getting the bottom of the barrel because you're going to get in the 20s in terms of a pick selection. You don't want all that. You have to get as much and maximize this deal, more important than any deal you've ever done in your history. Even the deals done wrong by Bill O'Brien, you were able to survive those, right? You might not be able to survive if you don't maximize what you get in return for Deshaun Watson because of the fact that you've been so highly limited with Bill O'Brien's remnants. Therefore, they got to get it right, and they got to know exactly what they're getting. Contingency plans? No. I mean, not knowing where a team's drafting? No. Desperation? No. Let it play out. Then at the appropriate time, make the right call.
Devil's advocate, if you trade him on the deadline date, November 2nd, that's 8 weeks into the NFL season. So you'd have an idea of what a team's going to be somewhat. I mean, what's that, about 40% of their season? The problem with that, though, is it's kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, right? Because, like, which team would trade for Deshaun Watson that's going to have a pick that's projected to be in the top 10? Like, they're not going to make that move on deadline day after week 8 whenever they've gotten off to a 2-6 start. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Why would Miami at 2-6 trade for Deshaun Watson at that point?
Because they know they're getting him and no one else is, maybe. But again, is that enough motivation for Nick Caserio? We've also talked about the whole negotiation theory where you got to have two teams to tango. If you got two, you push the price up. If you only got one, and we saw it with Bradley Roby, and right after they made the deal to send Bradley Roby to the Saints, oh, by the way, Baltimore lost Marcus Peters, and you're like, if you'd have waited one more day, you might have gotten a little bit of a bidding war. You might have been able to push that up.
And usually deadline day, too, is whenever contenders are adding to their team. Like, to me, there's not going to be many teams that are projected to be top 10 draft picks in the 2022 NFL draft that would be willing to make that move right then. One, because it's going to hurt the value of their own pick. And then two, why not just wait to the offseason? To me, there's not really any rush to get it done there for a team that's 2-6. To me, the biggest storyline, whenever you look at this season from like a Deshaun Watson perspective and what you hope to get for a Texans fan, is hoping that quarterbacks around the league suck. And Chris Mortensen with a couple of potential non-Miami destinations, perhaps, for Deshaun Watson at some point.
Well, we know that Philadelphia was interested, but right now, listen, they're intrigued by what they see in Jalen Hurts. This is kind of a prove-it year for Jalen Hurts. And who knows, they could make up their mind by November 2nd. But Jalen got off to a pretty good start the other day. Also, Carolina Panthers, I think they're good with Sam Darnold, but they have an owner in Dave Tepper who I think that if things went south there, that they would kick it up again. The Broncos seem content with Teddy Bridgewater right now, and they would want real clarity in terms of Deshaun's case. So I'm not sure that they're a team that would do it this year. And then the unknown. Is a team going to have a major injury? A team that we consider a Super Bowl contender that has enough value, draft picks, to be able to pull off that trade. So that's the X factor.
Those are a couple of the ideas of Mortensen for a team to trade for Deshaun during the season. In my opinion, as a Texans fan that is really embracing the suck and really embracing the rebuild and trying to expedite the rebuild and try to put a winning team on the field in, let's say, 3 years, what you need to be rooting for is for quarterback play around the league to suck. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of teams interested in quarterbacks in the offseason, thus enhancing the value and growing the value of one Deshaun Watson.
Jeremy, as I said the other day, the sleeper in my mind is the Atlanta Falcons, because after getting the snot kicked out of them by the Eagles, who were supposed to be bad too, it basically gave you all you needed to know about the fact that Atlanta could be god-awful. And they've already locked up with the draft last year, a highly, highly sought-after and touted tight end slash receiver-type player to go with another couple of young receivers they already have on the roster, to know that they're trying to rebuild with weapons. And the one thing they're missing is a quarterback, because they've had to stay latched on to Matt Ryan. If Matt Ryan is the guy that doesn't have the gradual decline like a Tom Brady and he falls off the cliff, or they just say, look, this is the guy we can't go with. Deshaun Watson used to be a ball boy for the Falcons growing up. Deshaun Watson loved the city of Atlanta. He wouldn't decline a trade to the Falcons. And if the Falcons continue to suck and they've embraced it more than the Texans, then guess what? Opportunity knocks and you go, I can get a higher pick with them than even with my own pick. And they get the guy they want, and we get another draft pick that we want.
Who are some surprise teams in the NFL that you think could be interested in Deshaun Watson, either at the deadline or in the offseason? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Coming up next, Thursday Night Football last night. Another good game. We dive into it next. The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, we know there was a game last night. We know there's plenty of college and pro games coming up this weekend. Well, you want a place to bet on them where you know your money's safe and they're going to take care of you as a customer? It's MyBookie.ag. For new and current and now former MyBookie customers, the deal is the same, and it's a deal that you've got to get involved with. It's doubling that first deposit up to $1,000. All you got to do is sign up or sign in right now and put in the promo code BET975. When you put money into your account up to $1,000, they are going to double whatever you put in. Put $100 in, you got $200 in your account. More money in your account means more games to play and more chances to win. That's the way they do it at MyBookie. And also, if you win and you want your money out, unlike the other sites where they're going to try and hem and haw and get you to reinvest it, they're going to pay you out if you want the cash now, because that's the other way that they know that they can keep and maintain happy customers by doing the things that the customer wants them to do. They're also going to have promos and lots of free plays where you don't have to put anything in, but you certainly can get something out if you win. They take care of the customers that bet with MyBookie.ag. Sign up right now, MyBookie.ag, put in the promo code BET975. The extra money is credited to your account instantly just for using that promo code when you make that next deposit. You can bet on your phone, your laptop, your tablet. It's easy, it's fun, and you know it's safe because it's MyBookie.ag. Check them out. Bet on MyBookie.ag right now. Bet on anything, anytime, anywhere with one site, MyBookie.
Who's this?
Hey, this is Trey Wingo. You're listening to ESPN 97.5 Houston.
Hello.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Now a 43-yard drive for the win. Good snap, good hold, kick is good. Washington wins it. A game that saw five lead changes, three in the fourth quarter alone. And this was some game here in Landover.
The great Joe Buck.
Shut up. That'll be the end of that. That'll be the end of that once and for all.
I thought I was going to slide that by you.
Shut up. I got the t-shirt that says, shut the buck up. Just shut up on that one.
I really thought I was going to sneak that one by you. It didn't. Nope. You weren't to be fooled. You're sharp today, little
not just
afternoon
today.
On a Friday.
Not just today.
That game last night, 2-0 a week for me, by the way. Nice start to my week.
No. Don't hurt yourself patting yourself on the back, Chief.
Great job. Way to get that, that early number. It didn't matter in the long run, but they went over. Certainly went over. this game to me, and look, that field goal was the second try. It was the mulligan, by the way. Dexter Lawrence jumping off sides on the field goal that was missed the previous snap. The Giants should have won the game. And I know this is like a good victory, if you want to call it that, for Washington, the football team. To me, it's just holding serve, if you want to borrow it from a tennis term. You're at home. You're playing the Giants team that you should beat. Like, Washington had way more to lose in that game than the Giants did. It was almost a really good win for the Giants if they want to be a playoff team, the cusp of the NFC. For the football team, that was just holding serve. To me, this was the very similar game to what we saw on Monday Night Football between Baltimore and Las Vegas. Like, neither team wanted to win. Both teams were making critical mistakes in the fourth quarter, late in the game. I feel like neither team should have won.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. It was a comedy of errors at a certain point. You're right. It's a lot like the Monday night game. You're looking at it. You're going, look, the good news is I'm going to stay entertained and tuned in because it's a tight game. But it probably shouldn't be because one team or the other had plenty of opportunities to, like, grab the bull by the horns and take control of the game. There was all kinds of stuff going on. Like, the sidebars were as good, yes. Like you mentioned. One, a missed field goal at the buzzer so that you can win it after the buzzer. A Joe Theismann-esque Washington involved in the game leg collapse that they refused to even show the replay on for the Giants lineman. I saw enough of it, and I'm like, and then someone was like, you know what? It's typical of an offensive lineman. They never want credit, and they laugh on the card as they're going away. Nothing in my head said that dude was laughing.
Who said that?
So it was on social media, and someone was writing a column about because of how tough and different linemen are. And I think someone might even quote it on it. I'm like, no, dude, no, not what that leg looked like. And then you've got the what's his name from the Lions yelling at Daniel Jones. Yeah, Galladay and Jones. And then everybody's trying, Galladay's not talking, but everybody else is trying to soft sell it. But then Judge says after the game, I saw him hugging in the locker room. It's all good. Yeah, okay, pull this leg and it whistles Dixie, right? Because I'm not buying any of that, but there was all kinds of sidebars. And then, like you said, you look at it and, like, who needed to win more? The one thing I was going to say from a football perspective, my biggest takeaway from the game is Heinicke can play.
He looked okay, but that interception he made on that second-to-last drive.
Okay, I'll counter that. That throw in the corner of the end zone was badass.
Good throw, great catch.
You're going to give that more to the catch when the ball had to be just it was the only place that ball could be positioned where it wouldn't be batted down or it wouldn't be picked off.
It was a good throw. I don't want to knock the throw.
Yeah.
I don't want to die on that hill. But that interception that he made on the second to last series that nearly gifted the game, should have gifted the game to the Giants. Like, how different are we talking about Heinicke today if Dexter Lawrence doesn't jump offsides? Here was Joe Judge after the game saying that offsides didn't lose the game. Really?
Well, we have to address it and just make sure that we keep putting players in position to prepare them properly and make sure we can work it and execute it the right way when it comes up right there. Obviously, something we don't want to have, all right, something that's not acceptable. But, look, we're not going to turn around and put this game on any one player or one play. There's enough things we can clean up as a team. We can play better going forward. So we're not going to go ahead and isolate one incident and say that's the difference in the game right there. So we got to make sure we do a lot of things better for 60 minutes.
Joe Judge, worst Belichick disciple? There's been some bad ones.
There has.
I am not a fan of Joe Judge.
You're not a fan of a lot of people. Not a lot of coaches either. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, who's worse. Because you've got, I mean, just go up and down the list of, you know, from assistant coaches to Scott Pioli. I mean, there's all kinds of guys that, to Bill O'Brien. I mean, you could just start pulling.
Bill O'Brien's going to be a better NFL coach than Joe Judge.
Matt Patricia. I mean, you can just keep going, right?
Ooh,
I mean, Matt
bad.
Patricia was awful, and then he couldn't even stand on his own 2 feet by the time he got out of Detroit. He had to have a kickstand cannon with that leg injury he had.
He almost ran over me. Remember they had the joint practices here, and he had his little, like,
scooter.
Leg wheeler or whatever. Yeah. He almost ran over me. Like,
oh, you're talking about a motorized one.
Yeah, he was on the four-wheeler.
Because he also had the little, the scooter that kept your leg elevated.
I think that was on game days.
Okay.
But this was a joint practice, so he would have to go from, like, field to field. And he had, like, a full four-wheeler, like, that he was driving around on the field. And media was allowed to, like, cross over from field to field, like, front side to backside. Uh-huh. And in between one of the sessions, I was walking over, and I looked to my right, and here's this dude just flying by. I'm like, whoa. And nothing. Nothing for Matt Patricia.
No horn, no my bad, no wave.
Nothing. I should have taken the charge in hindsight.
I mean, could have been financially very prosperous.
I would have had a cut of his buyout, I bet. Here was Heinicke after the game, and he was honest about that interception that he had and wasn't pleased with it. This is from his head coach.
Oh, he was pissed. He was upset at himself. He really was. He slammed his helmet into the ground. It was one of those things that you just felt if we can just get the ball back in his hands. And that's, you know, and listening to Jack talk to the defense, you know, he told him, hey, we got to stop here and get the ball back in his hands. And you know, we'll have a chance. And I really appreciated the way he put that to his defensive guys, because they went out and they did bow up, and we did get the stop.
Those are those sound bites that media members love. Oh, he was pissed. Well, what'd you expect him to be?
Right. I mean, if he wasn't, then he probably shouldn't be playing, or he's not playing for the love of the game for certain, because anybody should be pissed if they make a play like that. Look, I think that the other thing that really goes in Heineke's direction is the fact that he's got the best player on the football team in his corner, and Chase Young loves him some Tyler Heineke. And the fact that he did bounce back. You know what? It would have been different. I wouldn't be as impressed with him if that was the beginning of the end of the game, because he couldn't bounce back, and when he got the ball, he didn't do anything with it. You know, it could have been Baker Mayfield, but instead, the numbers were impressive. You're right. He made a couple of bad throws, but like almost every quarterback in the league last week made some bad throws. But you know what? That's not what you're expecting from that. Some starters made some bad throws. This is your second string quarterback coming in on basically short notice, but knowing, hey, now it's my team. I really got to step it up, and how much work he actually got in on a short week. And he led him to victory. And he put up good numbers. I was impressed by him.
I was actually impressed by both quarterbacks. And look, this was an ugly game, but I thought Daniel Jones against what's supposed to be a very good football team defense, he was impressive. And look, this is the knock on Daniel Jones, so don't text in 713-780-ESPN and say I'm a Daniel Jones apologist. The knock on Daniel Jones is you can't stack these type of games together. Like, he'll play pretty good one week, and then the very next week he'll throw four interceptions. But if the Giants can get this type of Daniel Jones, where he's completing a pretty good percentage of his passes, he almost ran for 100 yards. He had one called back, too, so he would have had two scores on the ground. I thought Daniel Jones looked solid as well. Like, Daniel Jones gave me some early, like, rookie Josh Allen vibes yesterday, when Josh Allen was just slinging it all over the field, fumbling, throwing picks. I think Daniel Jones has a chance to be all right in the NFL.
I've never been against Daniel Jones. Now, I was against where they drafted him, right? I thought they still could have got him at, what, 16, 17, instead of as high as they took him, 8 or whatever it was. But once I saw him and I got over the fact that Dave Gettleman overstepped in taking him as early as he did, whether you started calling him Danny Dimes right away or not, what you saw on film was a guy that picked up defenses quickly, a guy that went through his progressions accurately, a guy that made the right reads and could make the right throws. And he has some athleticism. We remember the stumbling, bumbling, rumbling run where he actually tripped over a line on the field. But to get to that point, to make the run that he made, showed you that he can, if he has to, he can tuck it and get some yards for you. I don't think there's anything. Giants fans are constantly always wanting to upgrade. I don't think this is a guy you have to upgrade from. I like I said, the only thing that I think is a knock is how high he was drafted when you could have had him lower. But other than that, I think they got it right.
Yeah, I don't think either one of these teams is going to be very good at the end of the day. Daniel Jones looked all right to me. I thought Heineke looked all right, too. Time to worry about Saquon Barkley. He had 57 yards on 13 carries, but 41 of those were on one carry. So you do the math on that. 12 carries, 16 yards on every other carry except for that long of 41.
Yeah, I mean, again, am I wrong to expect more because of the fact that because he is who he is and the hype that he
probably
came in. But I guess he's, you know, like I said, from a medical perspective, I probably shouldn't be as critical in my mind or want to be. I'm wanting to be more critical, but I have to understand and I have to catch myself, because this is something we talked about even yesterday. No matter how much technology has gotten better and better on operations like that, knee surgeries, even microfracture, but ACLs in particular, they always say you're not actually your old self again for at least a year. So, to his credit, he's back. He's back quickly. He's back for the entire season. I just don't feel like, obviously, he's the Saquon Barkley of old.
Fantasy football perspective, rest of the year, Saquon Barkley, Ezekiel Elliott.
Ooh, it's a great question.
713-780-ESPN. Saquon Barkley, Ezekiel Elliott, 713-780-3776. I need to see Zeke this week. Zeke last week scared me. I mean, there's a pretty good chance it was game plan specific against Tampa Bay. But I need to see a second game. I wouldn't have faith in either one of them.
I think there's going to be a really big focus this week in the game plan of getting Ezekiel Elliott off. And if they can early, get him a bunch of carries. But I think in my mind, they also understand that you can't keep doing that to Dak week in, week out, because at a certain point, he's going to get his head ripped off.
Chargers D ain't bad either. All right, coming up next, take a look at some of the college games this weekend. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Move over your sound! Real. Let's go! Fun. Sports. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, college games this week. Got some big ones. Got some good top 25 matchups. There's three top 25 teams that are playing against one another. That USC job, by the way, Mario Cristobal, the front runner, leaving Oregon for USC, move that you make if you're Mario Cristobal?
I don't think so. I mean, the thing is I never thought I'd say this previously, but Phil Knight's influence on Oregon is massive. And if you don't know, Phil Knight, the brains behind creating Nike, and he went to Oregon. He is the reason why they have the premier facilities for athletes in all of the country. This is the reason why, more than anything else, from the football team and the 8 to 10 different uniform changes they can make, to the fact that from their residence hall to their athletic facilities to their study facilities, they are head and shoulders above just about everybody, no matter what your budget is, because Phil Knight wants them to have everything so that they will be the best. I don't know that I walk away from that to go to South Central Los Angeles and take everything that's been out of date and back in the heyday of USC to try and have to resurrect everything, not just the program, the facilities, and everything that entices everybody except for the fact that you'd be playing in L.A.
You want to hear another coach lying through his teeth?
Sure.
All right, Eric Bieniemy asked yesterday what interest level he has for the USC job.
If USC were to reach out to you, is this a position that you would probably find yourself interested in?
I think you guys know me better than that. So if USC reached out to me right now, my answer would be I am preparing, all right, for this team to play against the Baltimore Ravens. And that's how I roll. You guys know that.
I like the answer. I don't think he's being completely honest. Although I don't think a coach should ever be honest in that situation. Go talk to my agent.
But here's the thing. He didn't answer the question.
I mean,
because he you know what? He might say that initially, fellas, I got a big week this week. We're preparing for a game. But by the way, I'd love to talk to you. So as soon as I get done with my prep work and everything that I got going on, I'd be happy to start the conversation.
Dell hosts Two Deep every Saturday on Sports Map Radio with Fred Davis. You're the AD of USC, Dell. Who are you hiring?
Ooh. My options are Cristobal, Bieniemy, or just anyone that seems realistic.
Anybody. Yeah, anybody that seems realistic.
Urban. You want Urban? You can have him.
That's less realistic, I think. I'm calling James Franklin.
Yeah, I think so.
And seeing what does it take? What does it take to get you out of... He's a Pennsylvania guy, so it might take quite a bit. But that's my first call. That's a proven winner. Didn't have a good year last year, but a lot of teams did not. Other than that, he's been to multiple New Year's Six games. In fact, USC faced him in a Rose Bowl.
More than Campbell. You're more on him than you are Campbell?
Yes, because I think Matt Campbell is one, at least, who seems like a Chris Peterson type who would prefer to be out of the spotlight. I think, and you're not out of the spotlight at USC, James Franklin seems like he would welcome that particular
energy.
Fickle? Fickle's another one who feels like maybe if a Big Ten job that's premier comes calling, maybe he would take the Penn State job if James Franklin left. But I don't think fit makes... means a lot in college football. Mm-hmm. I know you talk about great coaches anywhere, it'll work. If you're Saban or Urban Meyer, sure. But I think fit means a lot, and I think Fickell is a Midwest dude, and he probably doesn't want the lights of L.A. If you're good at USC, you're the star attraction in that city. That's what you have to contend with.
I'm with you on Campbell. Like, I don't think he wants to be at a prime spot like that. I'm with you on Fickell, too. I think Fickell, at the end of the day, he ends up at a Big Ten school. I think he's going to stay somewhere close to there.
I guess I don't understand that, though. I get being a Midwest guy, obviously, and from their perspective. But I also don't get, if I'm in this profession, then why am I not driven to be the best I can possibly be in this profession?
Right.
And to be the best, you need the spotlight. We know this. You need to be national TV. You need to be, and from a standpoint of recruiting, you got to be known in order to have kids say, look, I see your program, but I see you, and I want to play for you. I think that if you're going to do this profession of coaching, I guess I don't understand that way of thinking.
Yeah, I see your point, because, I mean, if you go to USC versus an Iowa State, I mean, who are the players going to go to? You can build a power at USC where you can build a really good team at Iowa State. Can it be a sustained power where you're contending for national championships year in, year out? probably not. Speaking of James Franklin, his team's one of the three matchups this week in college football where you have two top 25 teams going up against one another. Penn State, it's going to be a wide out there in Death Valley. They're home for Auburn. 5-point favorites against an SEC team. I know that there's other marquee games on the slate. This one certainly will have my attention.
It will, and I want to see what offense shows up for Penn State because they made the big deal in the offseason about changing the offense and opening it up more and doing more things, and maybe it was the Wisconsin defense, doubt it, and maybe it was the fact that they just had an off week. But overall from Penn State, I need to see more out of their offense. I need to see that they can absolutely utilize every weapon on their roster to do some things and put points on the board. Otherwise, I'm not going to be too impressed with Penn State. I mean, we don't know enough about Auburn except for their quarterback, so it should be at least a good matchup to watch, but I've got question marks on both sides, and I haven't seen Auburn play.
I hate to be an SEC honk, but Auburn getting 6 against Penn State, I know I said 5, I had 6 earlier in the week.
It's a great
home
field environment, though.
It is really good. I mean, it's going to be a great crowd, I think, and especially with the wideout, they seem to get really behind that as well. Speaking of the SEC, Alabama, number one team in the nation, Alabama, headed to Gainesville to take on Florida. Florida, the 11th ranked team in the country. Florida getting 14.5 points. First true test for Alabama. First true test for Bill O'Brien after they beat up on Miami there in week one. Sorry, Dell. But the Gators with a lot to prove here against the Crimson Tide of Alabama and Nick Saban.
They do, but yet I'm not sold on their quarterback play. I'm not sold on a lot yet with Florida. I'm completely sold Bill O'Brien or not on Alabama. And look, I know it's early in the season, but they got another one at quarterback, and that helps them immensely. And because I just said I'm not sold on Florida's quarterback situation, but I am in Alabama, and I am with the rest of their roster too deep and more, I'll take Alabama. I'll give the points, and I feel pretty good about it.
It's hard to bet against Saban. First half lines for Saban are usually something you'd like to pick on. I'm probably not going to touch that 14.5. You start to get to over 14. I don't love it, especially at Florida. And then the other top 25 matchup, Arizona State at number 23, BYU. Arizona State's number 19, Big 12. BYU getting 3.5 points at home against Arizona State. Dale, what's the most intriguing matchup for you this week? Which one is really going to have your attention?
You know, it's off the radar because of what happened to them earlier in the year. But the Cincinnati-Indiana game, I'm going to be paying attention to, speaking of Big 12, Jeremy. But it's one where Indiana has pointed to this and then the Notre Dame game as the two games that will vault them into serious contention for the playoff. Indiana didn't help their cause by losing to Iowa very early in the year. But it's a Power 5 matchup. You win that one, all of a sudden, maybe Cincinnati's one win away against a very beatable Notre Dame team from being seriously considered. It helps that Ohio State's already lost. We'll see what happens in the Pac-12, but that one I'm locked in on to see the first step for Cincinnati to maybe barge their way in. They got a win on the road at Indiana.
Yeah, it's one that's, they've had that game circled since the offseason, the Notre Dame game too, of course. And what kind of works to Cincinnati's favor in all of this, Indiana's not what they were last year. I don't think Notre Dame is what they were last year either. So Cincinnati might get the name value of beating an Indiana and a Notre Dame based on what they were last year, but not actually facing the competition of what those two schools were a year ago.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think it'll be a good game to keep an eye on because, look, the door's open, as we mentioned, for a lot of teams. There's not that solidified four that no matter what happens, and maybe even if they slip up and lose a game or two, that they're still going to be there at the end of the day. There's question marks, obviously, that were exposed last week with Ohio State against Oregon, and though they'll probably still be the cream of the crop in the Big Ten, you just don't know. And now Oregon's establishing themselves as a team to be reckoned with in a conference that's normally not looked at as a power conference to put a team into that mix. So you've got competition there that's going to be, you know, good to keep an eye on and see how it all develops and plays out. I'm not sold on Oklahoma or Spencer Rattler. So I want to see Oklahoma through that. Mention that again, Big 12 and their conference season. I want to see what Oklahoma can continue to do. And they need to impress me more on both sides of the football. And Spencer Rattler needs to impress me more as a quarterback than what I've seen. I know everybody can hype him up and say he's a Heisman candidate, but what I've seen of Spencer Rattler is not that been all that impressive to
me. Scott
Frost,
of course, on the hot seat there for Nebraska, the old Big 8 rivalry between those two schools. That normally would be fun. Oklahoma's a 22.5-point favorite in that game. Wisconsin the week off, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they have the week off Notre Dame next week. And then Houston opens up their home schedule at TECU Stadium Saturday. They face Grambling. It'll be fun. They're wearing the old school throwback jerseys to honor the 75th anniversary of U of H athletics. I'll be there. You can come hang out at TDECU Stadium tomorrow evening. Coming up next, what is the Astros' window? What is their World Series window? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5.